SBS Audio is supported by advertising.
Need a few minutes to reset? Great Minds is a podcast from SBS that guides you through different meditation styles from around the world. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we record, the Gammeraygal people and Gadigal people, and their elders past and present. If you watch locally made cooking TV shows, you'll know celebrity chef Khan Ong is a big deal. We start rolling tape the minute he enters the recording studio, and even though this is the first time we've met, he's very easy to talk to. And in moments, he's telling me about putting on Adele to listen to so he can have a big cry in the bath. And I start downloading about a bad experience I'd just had on a plane.
Yeah. I had a panic attack on last time I flew. Yeah. And I've never had one about flying.
Is it not the scariest thing ever, the panic attacks?
Oh, fucking hell,
man. It's the worst. And you feel like you might actually die.
Yes.
And the thing that we shortcut to before the interview has even officially started is that as a migrant kid, it's impossible to control the way you're seen. And under that scrutiny, you're always afraid of doing things wrong.
I've only had two in my life, and one of them, I was 17, I was in Laos on a school trip. I remember this moment because I tried to pour coconut into a glass and it was from a coconut because I wanted to eat the coconut.
Yeah.
And it spilled everywhere, and I was in this like little rural town restaurant, and I just felt like I'm this Western person that's just come here and I've just made a mess. So I just broke, I just went, and I just had the biggest panic attack.
Oh, wow.
But it was always a way, and it's when I feel like I'm being culturally not okay.
Yeah, right. You've got this pressure on you. Yeah. That's all self-imposed by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
I'm Yumi Steins, and today on Scene, we're going to explore the way even the most successful migrant kids have to fight to be seen on their own terms. And the fight isn't just about societal expectations. It can be a fight with yourself. We're also going to see once again how the expectations and pressures to be the model minority as a refugee kid means that it's an even bigger fight to exist outside of that perfectly cast role. Because who said you could be anything other than a doctor or a lawyer? Even being a chef wasn't considered an option. Nonetheless, Khan Ong got his break on the TV show MasterChef. So tell me about moments in your life, Khan, that have made you feel most authentically seen.
There was a time where I had like a penny drop moment where I cooked a chicken congee.
Khan is talking about a MasterChef cooking challenge where contestants cook a dish inspired by a personal photo that they bring to the show.
It was a photo of me, my dad and my mum the day that we were going to come to Australia. So it was like, I've got this little teddy bear backpack on, I'm in a suit, and we were supposed to cook something using that. So I cooked a chicken congee, which is peasant food. It's like a whole chicken in a big pot of rice that lasts for family for like 2-3 meals if you wanted it to. And I was just howling like through the entire cook. I couldn't do interviews. I couldn't do anything because I just remember going like, this is so important to me. And I really want this dish to do well because for me it's comfort, but it's also heritage and it's love. It's all of these things that food can show, but will they understand that? And that day I won that challenge and I was howling again when I was winning because I was like, something so simple that meant so much to me is finally being recognised. And I felt at that moment that there'll be a lot of Vietnamese families seeing a chow gia, which is a chicken congee, on Australian television win a challenge against all these other dishes. And I remember when I served it to the judges, I did it the same way that I would at home, where I was like, hey, I'm going to serve you guys because you're elders. Like, that's just what we would do. So that was a really, really important moment.
It was a really important moment because it was so much more than a dish from his past. It was a bid to be understood in a raw, exposed way. And for Khan Ong, that understanding was communicated via food, linking modern Australia with the refugee story of life in danger and jeopardy, years of determination, detention and resilience that brought Khan's family to Australia.
So Mum told me that what happened is you pay someone, you get on a boat, you sail towards Malaysia, the goal is to get caught. but in like not Vietnamese waters. Because then that way you then get transported to a camp where you can work out where you're going to be sent, if you're eligible to be a refugee for certain countries and things like that.
Wow. And did your mum understand that 4 years in a refugee camp was on the cards?
They knew that they wouldn't be coming straight to Australia. It's literally everyone's situation is different. It's anywhere between 6 months to years and years and years. But I think for them, it was, do we stay in Vietnam? Our future is totally unclear. Or do we take this risk? We might die. But also the other option is that we get a really great life. We start fresh in a new country with more opportunities. And that's the option that they chose.
When Khan says we might die, he's not exaggerating. Before his parents were detained for years in an Indonesian refugee camp where Khan was eventually born, they took the fabled journey of Vietnamese boat people.
Mum used to tell me about the boat being overcrowded, being in like waters that were dangerous, that were like stormy, like big waves, your ship breaking down. I think one of the engines broke down and Dad had to go change a propeller, so he had to dive under the boat. Like, they were attacked by pirates. It's all of these things that I think it's not true, because I'm like, that can't be. You can't, you didn't get attacked by pirates. And Mum's like, no, two people died. We got attacked by pirates, because pirates are a very real thing when you're a refugee. Why? Because you're leaving a country with all your most valuable belongings on you. So you're an easy target.
So what do you think when you see things like, I stopped the boats, or boat people go back?
It's a hard thing to see, right? Because that was me. Like, I literally was a boat person. And I feel as though the people who are trying to come here are looking for a better life. No one's going to openly choose to be in these waters where they could die if they think that there was a better life at home for them. So I think it's really hard. I find that, like, if we got sent back, I wouldn't be here, right? I might not be alive, because, like, my parents' life would be different. My life would be different. So I'm, like, really thankful that we were able to even come.
What do you think is missing from the refugee narrative?
Possibly humanity. Like, I think we're seeing people as numbers, we're seeing people as objects rather than as humans. Mm. And I think if we just put a little bit of humanity into that, I think arguments might change.
Tell me about growing up in Australia as a refugee kid.
I didn't think my life was different, not until my later teens. I grew up in Springvale. It's an area that's full of Vietnamese people, so there was a lot of people like me around that area, so I thought this was normal life.
And it was a normal life. If you listen to last season's episodes of this podcast, acclaimed artist Atonga Tim grew up on the Central Coast, thinking she was cute enough to be cast in Home and Away, completely part of the Aussie landscape, as did author Yasmin Abdel-Majid, until the culture worked to convince them otherwise.
And then when I went to high school, I went to Halebury, which is a private school in southeastern suburbs of Melbourne. Education is a massive thing to them, and I think to a lot of migrant families. So they put a lot of hard work in to get me to a school that they thought was really good for me.
Yeah.
So I went to Halebury and things changed. There was like more money. The cars were different than people were getting picked up in. The food was different. Like, it was like little things that I never noticed until high school. One thing that sticks in my mind, which I don't think a lot of people would even understand, because like you grow up watching it or seeing it on TV, cricket. I grew up in Springvale, which means that I wasn't watching cricket. I wasn't playing cricket.
No one was watching cricket in Springvale.
Exactly. Right? So I remember in year seven, they're like, okay, for PE today, we're playing cricket. And everyone was like, sure. And I was like, I have no idea what this game is. And I didn't want to feel different. I didn't want to feel left out. So I was like, yeah, I understand. And then I'm standing at the wicket, like being like, okay, so if I hit this ball, do I run or do I not run? It was as simple as that. It's like, do I have to run? Do I not have to run?
Yeah, just spell it out for me.
Like, what happens in this situation? Like, really simple things. And then the second time was when we were playing AFL. And I was like, yeah, cool. Get the ball, get the goal. Little tackle's fine, not above head, no issues.
Uh-huh.
No one told me I can't throw the ball. It's little things like that that aren't really explained to you because it's implied knowledge. Like, it's something that like everyone just expects kids to know. But I'm like, well, I don't know this because this isn't what I grew up with, right?
Kids pick things up quickly and will take on the local culture when out and about, then slip it off at the front door to home like a dusty pair of shoes. What's it like then to run around outside on the Aussie school playground, then come inside to your parents' home culture? The stereotype is that Asian parents are not demonstrative nor verbal with their love.
I grew up understanding the Vietnamese way of parenting. They were strict. They weren't scary. Like, they were. It's not like an abusive relationship or anything like that. But they were strict. They had, like, you know, you got to listen to your elders. You got to be respectful. You need to greet everyone. I think it's just... It's love languages, right? Dad never said that. Like, he's not telling me that... I don't think Vietnamese parents even say... I think I find it really hard to even say to my mom, I love you. I'm more like... I'm going to buy you things or I'm going to give you things. That's how we showed love. And that's how I think I was brought up to show love. Dad was always, you know, like, I would ask for something. He'll be like, no. And then 2 days later, it'll be there. Like, that's the kind of person he was, where it would just be like, he pretended to have a really strong, hard outer shell, but he was a massive softie.
They listened.
Yeah. Mum and Dad... they learnt about how Australia is as a society, as a country, very quickly. Their way of parenting changed to go with what I was going through, because I did go to a very, very open school. Mm. So I would be like, you know, this happens here, that happens there. So they were learning as I was learning. I watched them change a lot. They're more kind of like... the more that I lived in the country, basically. Mm.
That's really interesting, because a lot of migrant kids, their parents are frozen in amber,
yeah,
because they've brought over these really old school politics, and then at home everybody's evolved and progressed, but they've just kept everything as they remember it from when they moved.
I was a DJ for 8 years of my life, and Mum never didn't have a problem with it, but she never understood it. She was like, I don't understand how your job is to press buttons and, like, dance and have a vocaline soda. Like,
and go, woo!
Yeah, she never understood that.
Khan's parents' love language was providing, and that meant working really hard. Early on, Khan's dad worked for a butcher and eventually opened his own butcher shop, which became a series of butcher shops. Khan's mum was part of the business, and Khan himself worked there every school holiday.
Dad did everything that he could to kind of make sure that our family was in a place where we were comfortable, so much so that, like, Dad had Hep B that became liver cancer. He knew about Hep B for ages, didn't really get it looked after, didn't get it treated, because he wanted to work, he wanted to build up the family business, to the point where when he learned that he had liver cancer, we didn't know about it for a year after, because he then continued to want to work.
So he didn't tell you for a whole year?
Yeah, he didn't tell us for a whole year until he got to, I think it's stage four, where it was, like, the end, basically, and that's when... I think mum even only knew, like, a month or so before that. He kept that a secret from everyone because he didn't want to take away from the business. He was like, if I'm going to die, I need to make sure that you guys are set up so that, like, your world doesn't fall apart because I'm gone. That's the kind of person he is. So that's why I was like, I know that he cared a lot. At the time, I didn't react to it. I didn't do anything. I went to school the next day. It was the most, like, it was just another day to me, even though, like, I literally was in the lounge room when my dad passed away on the couch. And then I full had a meltdown, like, a year later. I was sitting in the car with Mum, and she was talking about potentially having a new friend in her life that was male a year after. And I literally said, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to talk about this. This went on for about 3 or 4 minutes where I just kept going, I don't want to talk about this. I just don't want to. She continued to talk about it. So we were rolling to a red light and I opened the door and rolled out of the car and then had to walk home for like 2 kilometres.
Oh my God.
We didn't talk about really anything going on in her life for a while after that, because I, like, that was probably the worst way to react to that conversation is, like, literally leave the conversation, try and kill yourself, like, roll out of a moving car just to get out of the conversation. That was horrible for my mother, especially, like, looking back, it's one of the worst things that I could have done. And our relationship really took a turn around that moment. It was my last schooling year, so it was like 9 months left of schooling, of high school, and I remember I was 100% going to move overseas because I just wanted to get away from my mother. I didn't want to be around her. I didn't want to be like, but she hadn't done anything wrong. It was just like the way that I was grieving that I hadn't grieved. So I was like, how dare you a year later think about having a normal life.
And love and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And like just, you know, move on, even though like you've lost the love of your life and you have the right to move on now. Mm. How dare you?
Khan wasn't seeing his mum. And at the same time, he was unseen by his mum. He was gay, but not out to her. And he was grieving. Khan applied a revolutionary coping mechanism. Yep, he ran away. He applied to fashion school in London, far from his family. And during this time, Khan barely spoke to his mum.
Highs and byes, that kind of vibe, really, really closed off.
Turns out, London was not for Khan.
I was in London for about 9 months when I figured out that I hated being in London. It's grey and no one smiles at you. And I just hated it. So I came back to Australia and I apologised to my mum because I realised that, like, I was a brat and what I did was not okay. And I remember sitting down and just being like, hey, it's okay for you to have friends / date. Like, I don't have the right to tell you not to do that. And I think it's actually really unfair that I even went down that route.
The bruising experience of London was humbling enough that Khan did some growing up. He came back ready to rebuild his relationship with his mum, and that included facing the terror and potential ostracism of coming out to her.
I don't think being gay was really a thing for mum's generation, especially in Vietnam or even like in her friendship group. And being a refugee, a Vietnamese refugee, they have this thing in the community where everyone is very, very competitive with their children. And it's like, my child got into this school, my child did this. And it's like, I didn't want to be there. My child's gay. There was this thing sitting at the back of my mind where I just didn't want to disappoint my mother.
Yeah.
Because like she's gone through so much with everything in her life. And I just didn't want to be that disappointment. And I was so scared, so nervous about it because you're like, you're keeping this in for so long and you think about all the things that could happen and you always go, worst scenario. What you're hoping for, but here's the worst, there is no best. There is no like, cool, mum's going to throw a party. It's either she's chill with it or I get disowned.
Khan didn't know what to expect, but he was ready.
When I came back, I apologised, and that's when I really did go, okay, I need to be truthful to my mother now. So that's when I came out.
Mm.
She then turns to me and goes, we need to send you back to Vietnam. And in my mind, I was like, conversion therapy wants me to, like, be straight. She goes, you know, a lot of people in show business over there are part of the LGBTQIA+ community. We can make you famous in Vietnam. And I was like... Did you just kind of throw a party? But also, what the fuck, mum?
She's great. Let's milk our little gay boy. You're going to be a moneymaker.
I know.
It's so good.
Look, I think she would have seen all the signs. She would have, like, realised that I'm super creative as well, that, like, I was obviously going to end up doing something in show or in media or something. So she really kind of thought that. It wasn't like a, you're gay, make you a pop star. I don't think that was her train of thought.
She got the context.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a previous life, Khan Ong worked as a DJ, and it was baffling to his family, who couldn't understand why their son, who was educated and clever and charming and charismatic, wasn't on the migrant son pathway toward being a doctor, a lawyer, or, gosh, at the very least, an accountant.
She never understood my tattoos. She never understood the clothes that I wore, any of that, until I went on MasterChef. The day that I went on MasterChef and she saw it on TV, she goes, I get it. Because for her, she would watch these people on Vietnamese television and their kind of like personalities and stuff, right? And she was like, I never understood that this was who you were. Like you're destined to be a personality. Like this was like, you didn't have to conform with any of the other things that I thought was normal. She understood it all once she took me out of like being a good Vietnamese son and put me into like this own little space where I have my own career.
All at once, Khan was seen in completeness by the person who mattered most,
It took the full Technicolor unfiltered TV version of gorgeous gay Khan to finally help his mum see all he could be.
What does she think of you now?
She's my biggest fan. She's annoyingly so. I love her for it. But like, we'll go to Springvale and she literally, I'll be like, hey, let's go get some fish. And she'll take me to 15 fish shops because she wants to parade me around. Which is the sweetest thing. But sometimes I'm like, okay, I need to go get this thing. She's like, okay, cool. Can we do the lap of that? I'm like, we're not doing any laps. Yeah. I need to go to that shop and buy that thing and come back. This is not going to be a 45-minute exercise where you talk to everyone about me coming home for the night.
Aww.
My mother is the best. She's very proud because I think in her mind, she's like, my son is on TV. I've won.
My mum used to love it when I was on TV. She'd text everybody, turn on the TV.
Oh, babe, she literally has a photo of me in some of her stores. Like, just like there in my MasterChef apron doing this. I'm like, can you upgrade the photo? Because I look a lot better now than I did back then.
It's funny to me that Khan's mum understood who he could be because she had seen people like him on Vietnamese TV decades before. But Khan grew up on a diet of Australian culture and Australian TV. So tell me about having role models growing up as a queer Asian man. Was there anybody that you saw that looked like you, like whether in real life or in media?
Not that I remember. Yeah, I'm like, you're like, tell me about them. I'm like, I can't because I don't really know any of them. I don't. You know, the only person that I really remember, he's not queer, but I just remember going, Huey's got a really cool life.
Who?
Huey's Cooking the Adventures.
Khan's talking about celebrity chef Ian Huey Hewitson, a jolly, straight white man who always seemed to be gasping for breath. Huey's been around forever, but he's not queer or Asian. And his food seems to be for people who drive Winnebagos and know the rules to cricket. So Huey's the only person that comes to mind when Khan's trying to think of queer Asian role models.
That's not the person, but I just do remember being like, this man's got a really cool life and he's always talking about olive oil and he's always by some seaside town on a wharf cooking calamari. Like, this is sick. But I don't know, there weren't any queer role models. Like, later on, I think it was like early 2000s when we had people that were queer.
Mm.
Our society then wasn't really celebrating them. They were there as a token funny thing. And I think that's changed a lot. Mm. I feel as though that like it's really great that it has changed so much that people who are queer are being celebrated. But like I didn't really see that at all in my late teens to early 20s.
Khan wants a world where queer kids don't grow up only seeing breathless white cooks on the TV. He wants them to see people who look like them doing anything.
For me, it's more about like this next generation. They need to be able to see that you can do whatever you want, you can be whatever you want, and just it's okay. It's fine. My nails have flames on them. Like my hair is pink, but I still have roles where I'm super corporate. And it's fine. It's a new world where you shouldn't be judged for the way you look, the way you act, or the way you speak. I thought that I had to act a certain way for ages. And I did that for like the first half of the season of MasterChef, where the way that I spoke, the way that I interacted with the judges was very much contained. It was gay, but it was appropriate gay, what I thought was appropriate gay.
Right.
Whereas now I'm like, this is just me.
Just be bigger gay? Is that what you mean?
No, it's like, you know, like, don't be flamboyant. Be the perfect gay man. Don't be a caricature of, like, a gay man. I'm like, but I'm not. This is just how I am.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I get excited. Whenever I see a dog, I smile. When I get sad, I cry. Don't judge me for crying just because I'm sad. If I'm emotional, I'm allowed to be emotional. It's not weak. It's strength.
If you can picture that young guy opening the door of a moving car to escape a painful conversation and line him up against this guy, it truly is a wonder how much growth can be crammed into one lifetime.
Growing up, I really wanted to be what my parents would respect or what my parents wanted. All through high school, I was going to be a surgeon, reconstructive plastics. Like it was like something that was like this kind of negotiation that like my parents and I had. They were like, we want you to do medicine or be a lawyer. And I was like, I can be a surgeon. and I can do reconstructive surgery because I like that. That sounds important to make someone feel good about themselves. And then slowly, the more that I came out of my shell, the more that I experimented with what I loved, what I liked doing, the more that I thought that I could do certain things. But then I never actually thought that I could be a cook.
Mm.
I think that there's this idea that being you can't make a career out of food unless you're a chef, as in like you have to work in a restaurant. You need to work in a restaurant for 60 hours a week and be upset and yell at people.
Yeah, and have no family that like you.
Yeah, and I'm like, that's not what I want to be either. So like the life that I currently have was never a life that I thought that I would have. I don't think the jobs that I currently have I thought would be jobs that I could have. Like you would see people on TV, you know, doing like cooking and traveling. And I'm like, that's one person out of like maybe a billion people that get that job. That's not for me. Like there is no me there. Mm. So I'm really, really appreciative that I kind of get to do that with my life. And it makes me so happy. Like I'm like waking up in Vietnam, okay, and going down and eating like a bún bò Huế or something like that and being able to talk about it and being able to film it and then share it is the coolest thing. I still think it's the best job in the world.
Now a young Khan out there can turn on the TV and see someone just like him, a queer Vietnamese man hosting a cooking show, having a cool life and talking about olive oil in idyllic locations.
And I'm just really, really happy that, like, there are kids growing up now that can kind of see that that is a possibility more and more, that, like, kids are being more exposed to this world where they have bigger opportunities because they're seeing people of all different shapes, sizes, skin colours, like minorities, just doing what they love and really enjoying it and making a living off it, which is fucking beautiful.
This has been Seen. If you found Khan as funny and delightful as I did, make sure you like and share this episode and don't forget to follow because the upcoming stories are just as excellent. This podcast is hosted by me, Yumi Steins, produced by Audiocraft in collaboration with SBS. From Audiocraft, Season 2 of Seen was produced by Mandy Yuen and Laura Briley-Newton. Sound design and mix is done by Ravi Gupta and executive producer is Kate Montague. The SBS team are Caroline Gates, Joel Supple, Max Gosford and Mickey Crossman. Our podcast artwork is created by EBO Studios and music is by Yo. Scene's original concept was by Bernadette Phung Nam Nguyen.